This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week, we'll continue our chats with American composers, and today visit with one of the most important composers of the last decades, single-handedly ushering in a neo-romantic movement back to tonality, David Deltredegi. Going to school in Berkeley, California, he was on track to be a pianist when French composer Darius Milhaud complimented him on a composition and set his course in that direction. He dutifully followed the mid-20th century dogmas and processes at Princeton and Harvard, and he had success, but he felt boxed in, despite drawing praise from and having Aaron Copland as a mentor. Then when George Schulte and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra commissioned him open-endedly, he turned to his passion, literature, but not James Joyce, who he had already set to music, but rather the Alice stories of Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. Not the stories directly, but rather a commentary book on these stories by Martin Gardner. It also led him, shockingly, to abandon the atonal methods of composition and reintroduce tonality, key centers, and consonants, springboarding the neo-romantic movement to life, and thus launched this multi-prize-winning composer on a nearly 30-year odyssey of creating works from this literary source. There were orchestral works all the way to operas, all well-received, recorded, and awarded. The part one of his two-part Child Alice won him the Pulitzer. The complete two-part Child Alice has recently been recorded, for the first time complete, by the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, led by Gil Rose, and released on their label. You're listening to the opening minutes of the first movement of part one, called Simple Alice. The voice is that of soprano Courtney Budd. My guest's post-Alice period has been focused on social issues, especially music reflecting and celebrating the gay community. Now 80 years old, this composer, who has been a maverick and been labeled our most flamboyant outsider composer, continues to contribute and create, and I caught up with David Deltredegi at his apartment, acting as his creative space in New York City back in October. Here today with composer David Deltredegi. It's great to meet you. We've been at various events, and I've seen you in the decades I've been in the record business and classical music business. We've passed, but I've never formally met you, so it's nice to meet you.
What labels were you with?
Oh, geez. Well, I managed the Tower Records store for Philadelphia for years, and then Naxos, and all kinds of things. So anyway, and we're here talking today, particularly, because of the release on the Boston Modern Orchestra Project, here for Bebop, of Child Alice, the first complete commercial recording. It's great. I guess this is the third time the whole thing has been performed, start to finish, first note to last note.
Or is it the second
time? Might it be the second.
I think it's the second time the whole thing has been performed.
Well,
yes.
I don't know. It's kind of, we'd pick your word here, but was with the release of this and the performance, I mean, was there a little bit of sense of fulfillment, accomplishment, satisfaction that finally, you know?
Oh, it's certainly. I never thought in my lifetime that I would hear the whole thing recorded. Yeah. And one time it was done, they thought it was so, the demands were so extreme, they had three singers do it. They're three different parts. But now this is the way I dreamt it, with one singer doing all of it. And it's a wonderful performance, wonderful sound the Bebop gets. It really, very Stokowskian sound, and the soprano is marvelous. And so I'm very, very happy with this. And it's packaged so gorgeously. Who else does that? Bebop is unique.
I agree, yeah.
Gil Rose is a genius at doing this, and I'm very appreciative to be on the receiving end of that, of his skill and expertise.
Yeah, Gil was a guest of mine last year in Cadenza, and just the work they do. I mean, there's a number of organizations throughout the country that do contemporary music as an orchestral entity, but they carry it to the next step with the recordings and all the rest.
Yeah, I think this is their most expensive project, he told me, because it is a big orchestra and it's a long piece. The two things which cause money to go up.
So. While we're there, our listeners may know the pieces, they may, but just a little, the Alice period.
The confusion of all my Alice pieces, how do they make sense?
Well, I was reading up, and I don't know if I agree with it, but, you know, the comparison to Mahler with the obsession with Diskknaben Wunderhorn, but if you could just revisit, just for the listeners, just, it wasn't the stories as such, it was a take on the stories through another publication that really sort of drew you in.
Right. I've always been affected very much by authors. I write my music to make the author come to life. And at first it was James Joyce. And when that was waning, someone gave me Alice in Wonderland and said, I think this is for you. I looked at it and said, it's not for me. And then, as you mentioned, I found the book Annotated Alice by Martin Gardner. And that made much more sense to me. It explained the different connections. And more importantly, it gave me more texts. Like the Alice poem would be based on this and that earlier poem, or one would be a parody of something of the day, which I didn't know about. So I had suddenly a whole collection of contrasting texts to make a piece out of. So it began then to be more than Alice. It was a whole exegesis on Alice, my interpretation through the different versions of it. Sometimes he hid them, alluded to them. So I brought out all the hidden allusions, and he certainly tried to hide his own love interest in Alice, which I bring perhaps achingly to the surface.
So as you started to dive into this, I mean, we're not talking a couple pieces or a few years. This almost spans 30 years. I mean, when you were in this, was there just, being an old composer myself, was there this thing that you couldn't get away from it? You had to keep drawing back to it? Did you forcibly put yourself? I mean, I'm just curious. In this whole time, you said, I'm going to go back again.
Well, I didn't imagine I would do this. You know, yeah. I didn't plan 30 years, 25 years. I wrote one piece, then another piece. And when I got to the one I call Final Alice, the final was twofold. One was the fact that it was the end of the book, but the other was, this must be the last one I write. It's got to be my Final Alice. But then after that came an even bigger piece, Child Alice.
Right.
And after that, an opera called Dum Dee Tweedle. So I had miles to go. It horrified me as much as it might have horrified anyone else.
And Child Alice, that's the preamble text, as it were.
Yeah, it's a very minimal text.
Yeah.
Really. The opening preamble poem, but from two points of view. First, from the child hearing the poem, Lewis Carroll telling it on the Thames River. Then there's an interlude, which is a tale he told the children but got away. He didn't write down. So it was an excuse to have a big orchestral piece. And the final version is the same poem as glimpsed by the author who was telling it. So a very different point of view, being so much older. It's a very much different version of the same poem. There are actually two books, of course, of Alice, and there are two preface poems to each part. So I did it twice.
Not to belabor the point, but was there a time when you were doing these pieces where you said, I can't go back there again, and like you couldn't help yourself? I mean, I'm just curious, because there's a mindset.
I couldn't help myself. If I had been rational, I would really never have done it. Yeah. I would have never have done it. I actually wrote Child Alice all at once, in one big thing, but then it was so unreasonable a length that when commissions came along, which they were coming, I cut it in pieces and gave different parts to different people, had to give titles to them. So some of the different parts have names, and that's why. But they were all conceived as one continuity.
And the reason they're important, not just for you, well, I mean, first of all, the first part of Child Alice got you a Pulitzer Prize, okay? And that's great.
Yeah.
It changed you as a composer, and Cards on the Table, it
redirected American music in some fashion, and that's really important. I mean, there are benefits of this long obsession with this that are historical almost, you know.
Well, yes, it was a surprise. I did not plan to change anything, but I was merely following my own fantasy about making these stories in Alice in Wonderland come to life. I wanted them to live, but I couldn't use any more for some reason. And I didn't know, atonality. It didn't fit the Victorian wit, the whimsy, the charm. All of that was not atonal. So I did grasp for tonal chords and things I thought made it come to life. And in that process, little by little, I realized, I'm doing something that's wrong, quote unquote, wrong. Certainly, it was unthinkable to do such a thing. And I did it thus very cautiously. In the beginning, just a few chords, and then I got more and more. And finally, by coincidence, when I wrote Final Alice, the longest piece and the one with the most public exposure, it was also the one that had the most tonality.
Right.
In the earlier Alices, the tonality would sometimes be covered up by a scrim of wrong notes, so you kind of glimpse it as if from the past. But when I got to Final Alice, the wrong notes never came, so I was stuck with all this tonality. And then I really was terrified and had a sort of nervous breakdown. I thought, I can't go on. I can't do this. My colleagues will think I'm crazy. But then I thought, this is what my instinct gives me. It gives me now tonics and dominants, so it used to give me minor sevenths, minor ninths. So I'm going to just go with it. Whatever the punishment is, I'll accept it.
Were you back at the time, had that much angst about what your colleagues would say? Was it really that kind of arena that, like...
Yes, because I didn't have a public. There's no such thing as a public. But I just had, you know, people who went to the concerts and my friends and who were all atonal. I just, you know, that was my judgment world, you might say.
But then validation, I think of the old Mozart quote, you know, like with Magic Flute, where he used to look like walking down the street and hearing the people hum the tunes as they walked past. I mean, you had people walking out of the house humming something that they'd just heard for the first time, which had not been done for many long time.
It seemed to have been an earworm, as they say.
Yeah, well, good. but then also, I mean, the Pulitzer, was that kind of saying, aha, you know, was that a moment where you said, okay.
Well, it was a great surprise that I would... With that style, to get a Pulitzer right away, it was a big leap for the Pulitzer Committee to give it to me, and it was certainly validation. It certainly made me, got me tenure, got me a better job, and with a bigger salary. So that was all very good.
As this all happened, I mean, we're still kind of in the arcing point of the Alice period. Did you hear from composers who were trying to hold on to some basis of tonality in their processes? Did you hear from them saying, I got to know your thank you or God bless you or something
like
that?
As the years went on, I certainly did. But people would say, I turned on the radio and I heard this weird piece. I thought, is this some Strauss opera I've never heard before?
Right.
But then it was too dissonant for that. So they did say they couldn't believe that something like this existed and that therefore they could re-embrace tonality if they'd given it up, which many of us had. The reason it was so exciting to do dissonance, it was really a wonderful, thrilling thing. We were coming from a world of Copland and Barber and Menotti, kind of the so-called wholesome Americana,
right. Which
was wonderful in its own right, but it was not something we wanted to continue. And then when this sort of green fog from Europe came, called Schoenberg, you know, Berg and Webern, it was thrilling to be enveloped in this strange new mist. And so I certainly got involved in it, and I went to Princeton, which was a hotbed of advanced thought. And I wrote a number of pieces, you know, Joyce pieces that were quite atonal. But I got tired of it and wanted to go somewhere else. Thus, the text of Alice in Wonderland appealed to me, because without my realizing it, I think my instinct thought that if you get involved in this, it's going to change the way you write, because it's a completely different world. You're going to have to find the musical equivalent of that new world.
Well, that's what I love about the twist about your career, is that you didn't do this because you were always holding on to something. You had gone, quote-unquote, to the dark side. You were writing atonal music.
Yeah.
You liked it. You enjoyed the freedom of it. And then you said, it doesn't fit, which was pretty cool, because it was just your own, it doesn't work for me, you know? That took a lot of balls.
Well, I was so to speak, I was hypnotized by the story. That whatever the story wants, I'll give it to the story. And I didn't think about the repercussions until I had done it. And then the other side of my brain kicked in, the socially conscious side, said, you can't do this. This is wrong. People are not going to like it. And so I had to reject that. Finally, that was the final thing I had to reject and just accept what I had done, regardless of the price I'd have to pay.
So a bit more from the new release on the Boston Modern Orchestra Project label, with that ensemble led by their music director Gil Rose. This, the end of the second movement of Part 1 of Child Alice, by my guest David Del Tredegy, one of the orchestral non-vocal interludes called Triumphant Alice.
how did you then compositionally and creatively come post Alice? How did you say, that's it, that's enough?
Well, it was never that...
Final. I know it was, you didn't wake up on a Tuesday and say that's it.
Just after a certain time, I got a commission or something that directed me another way. And I also got interested in making my own gay nature. I wanted that to come out in music. Gay people had set suggestive poems, like Minotti, Barber. All of them were gay, but no one ever said they were gay. Certainly they never composed music about being gay. And I wanted to take that extra step and write music that was incontrovertibly gay. And often I did that by setting texts that you could not... We were forced to be gay. Certainly there are all these poets, wonderful poets, who wrote explicitly gay texts. So I started to set them. I wanted there to be a library of music which was gay. The only way you could see it was gay and sexual. And you couldn't get away from it. Like, people would set the poem, that who's a Russian male poet, who, like, he changed the pronouns. So it should have been two men, and it was he and she. And
oh, like what the kids do now with they.
Yes.
That's what they did. Other kids don't do he or she, they do they.
That's true.
Well, you jumped there. I was going to go there later, but since you're there, we'll go there. So you thought, I'm gay, I want to celebrate it in music.
I want to celebrate, that's the right word, yes.
And you saw that classical music, I mean, it's true, is one of the real conservative, the bastions.
The last of all.
And it has been. I mean, things are changing. But when you started to think that, setting poems is one way, and of course you're so aligned to text, I mean, were there ways you say, this is how I want to go about doing that, besides just text, or was text the way in?
The text was certainly the way in. But then I would name pieces, like I have a same-sex marriage thing, and I'd... mummification. I have all kinds of different things which are only gay. It, just like the people used to write Schumann or so, like descriptive pieces, like Carnival. So I wrote, you know, a Carnival, but all the characters were gay and the events were gay. And there's no Ferris wheel, but there'd be a mummification center or something. It was relatively easy to do once I accepted that I was going to do this and make it.
Did you know you would have to, and you wanted to also make it into social statements? I mean, Bully Side is on the new CD, I know, Albany, but I mean, there are issues connected with that which need to be brought to light, and if people aren't going to listen to people saying it, maybe music can do it.
Yeah.
I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, but just before I write a piece, I have to cry or be touched deeply by it. And the Bully Side I could relate to very much because I was bullied a lot in high school. Right. And so I really identified with that. And it happened that there were about four or five kids who did this all at one time. It just shocked me. It was enough to get me going.
Here's some chamber music by my guest, David Deltretigy. In the past years, he is composing a body of music, as he states, that will unambiguously celebrate the gay experience, good and bad. This two-part multi-movement piano sextet is titled Bully Side, and the opening of this second part is called The Names and has the musicians whisper names of five Bully Side victims. Margaret Kempmeyer is at the piano, Curtis Macomber, Anna Lee, Mark Gustafson, Christopher Finkel, and Jeremy McCoy on strings.
Watch.
So in today's climate, where it is so toxic and it is so discriminatory and driving wedge, I mean, is there still a drive in you to keep the message coming through music, or you're hoping a younger generation sort of picks it up? And
well, my instinct is very fluid. I mean, it goes where it wants to go. I don't.
All right.
Setting out to be a message is not a good way to write a piece, I think. Like, for example, when 9/11 happened, which was right around here, and I saw it all and smelled it all and saw the traffic, I became intensely political and wrote pieces inspired by patriotism, something I'd never taken. So I wrote The Ride of Paul Revere.
Right.
And I wrote another piece, which was just done in Albany, Rip Van Winkle. I never would have guessed I was going to do that, but that's what somehow got me going, and I did a couple of pieces to that. And then it moved on, and I had to go with it. Now, most recently, I fell in love with two Irish men, and suddenly I wanted to write Irish poetry to remember, to somehow make the experience, put it in concrete. Yeah. That's one thing I love about composing, is you can put something down and it's there forever in some form, and I like that. It doesn't disappear. I began my life as a pianist, and I would practice, you know, for hours and hours, and then it comes to the concert and I get scared and I make a big muff of it. But with composing, once you get it right and you write it down, it's there, and I like that, the permanence of that.
What I really like about your career, are there points in your career where something happened, you met somebody, something was said, which sort of helped you make a decision, and it's not always clear for a lot of artists. You start as a pianist, so you write a piece of music, and one of the well-known 20th century composers, Darius Milhaud, says, you're a composer. So that changes, you know. You said, like, you go to Princeton, and you felt yourself being suffocated by the isms and the processes that were strangling everybody at that point. Mm-hmm. And you said, I got to get out. So you meet Phyllis Brynjolfsson, you hear her sing, and you go, oh, okay. Even the commission from Schulte and the CSO to say, basically do anything you want. I mean, there's interesting points where your life goes like this just because
I was
happened.
Given a lot of opportunities. And also meeting Aaron Copland was a big...
Copland was a mentor.
Did a lot for me. And I really appreciate that that happened. I mean, I quit Harvard as well for the same reason I quit Princeton. And it was a little different. Princeton was suffocating me, as you say. Harvard was just—it was taking too much of my energy teaching.
Yeah.
I did not want to remain just a teacher. I could only compose then in the summer, and that wasn't enough. So I did quit it. And at first, it always seemed like a mistake. I didn't have a job for a year, and I didn't know what I'd do for money. But things righted themselves. And I've been lucky to be able to follow my instinct pretty much of the time. If it says to go, to quit, I quit. And I don't know why, actually, but I just do it. So I'm glad of that. I recommend it.
One turn is of late, maybe. What? There's a young gentleman, Mark Pelican.
Oh, yes, a wonderful pianist.
Who's recording for Naxos, your piano music. Mm-hmm. And you said that because of someone saying, hey, yeah, I'd like to do your piano works, it sort of rejuvenated you to come full cycle in your career and back to the piano.
That's true. I had stopped writing piano music for the longest time.
Yeah.
25 years maybe, and he came along and got me interested again.
That's great. I mean,
it's his fault I've written so many, you might say, gay-themed piano pieces, and it was to amuse him, and he was eager to play it. Nothing like someone wanting your music to be a stimulus to writing music, I must say.
I mean, it's going to continue. Obviously, it's a series, and Naxos always does series, and Volume 1 came out, so I assume there's a lot more coming out.
Yeah, there's probably four volumes. But I've got I think he gets nervous when I keep writing piano music. But he likes it, and he loves it, but at the same time, oh my God, more volumes.
It's great. I mean, the Waldteufel last movement, the Woman's Rig thing on the Gotham thing is
oh,
I know you're basing it on the Skater's Waltz, but it's great. It's wonderful stuff.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Pianist Mark Pelican is recording the piano works of my guest David Deltredegi on the Naxos label. Here from Volume 1 are the final minutes of the final movement from his four-movement Gotham Glory, four scenes from New York City from 2004, the movement's West Village, Museum Place, Missing Towers, and this, Woman Rink, a grand fantasy on the famous Skater's Waltz of Emil Waldteufel. Thank you.
You mentioned Aaron Copland. He did do some teaching. And Copland
I've always
was,
taught.
Copland was a mentor. He said of you, well, I'm going to give you the quote, you know the quote, but I know of no other composer who composes music of greater freshness and daring. When you were being extremely fresh and extremely daring, you were in a time where music was straitjacketed in some way, da-da-da-da.
I have to tell you, actually, he wrote this before I went tonal.
Wow.
He didn't know. I hadn't written yet anything tonal.
That's even
so he based it on my Joyce pieces.
Wow.
I guess, yes. It was,
I was just wondering, because of teaching, and you get to see the younger composers now, and they are just open to write any style, draw influences, and
true.
From anywhere they want to go. So if Copland said that about you decades ago, I mean, how does a composer be fresh and daring today?
Oh, personality, it's hard to squelch.
Yeah?
I mean, personality shows in no matter what you do. But it's very interesting, a different time when everything is okay, that is another problem, I think. Then when it's very restricted, sometimes that's better, and you're forced to do one thing because then you realize you don't want to do one thing, and then you do something else, and so you have only two things to worry about. But like I was up in Albany doing my Rip Van Winkle, and I went to the sound man, and I said, what can this board do? He said, everything. I was flummoxed. I thought, oh my God, what does everything mean? What, can it do a little echo? But it's true, like the computer can do anything.
And right.
Everything's possible, and every key you can, I don't know.
Well, I mean, do you find the younger composers either turning to you or asking questions of, how can I set myself apart? I mean, how do you be fresh when anything coming out is just fresher than the next piece and the next piece next to it? It's just, there's no avenue that you're taking the other lane from. Everybody's in the same six-lane highway.
But freshness, and I think it's a byproduct of being intensely interested in something you want to do yourself, like some idea about music you want to put into form, into some physical form. It can be very weird. I taught a course at Yale called My Secret Music, and I think everybody has a music they write that they're ashamed of. Certainly this was my case with tonality. I was ashamed of it, basically, but still did it. And I think everybody, because when you go to the university, there's a kind of style, no one tells you this, but it's quickly perceived that you're supposed to write in. It's sort of international, dissonant, not atonal anymore, but kind of dissonant. Always. A certain level of acceptable dissonance. So I tried to get them to open up about it and have them write their life story. And it turned everybody did have something. Like in some cases, it was jazz, which they were ashamed of. Sometimes it was folk music, even more shameful. Then they'd have to write a piece using that. And the feelings that came up were so interesting. They said, I feel so ashamed to be doing this. But once they did it, it tended to become part of their style.
Here is soprano Phyllis Brynjolfsson, along with the Festival Chamber Orchestra led by Richard Duffalo, in some early music of my guest David Del Tredegy, the first movement, Ecce Puer, of The Dark Past, A Child is Born, from his 1966 Syzygy.
Thank you.
Over the decades, you dabbled with bringing in different tone colors that are associated with other styles of music, be they jazz or rock or folk. You didn't do it as a, well, I mean, it provided a special effect in the music at the time, but you did it, well, why did you do it? I don't know, I guess maybe turn the question around.
It was just a sound I liked. I thought I could use it, like you say, it appealed to me. It fits some visual image, like perhaps you're thinking of, I wrote a piece called The Last Gospel,
yeah. And
I used rock group. I wanted something shocking, something completely irreligious. And what could be more irreligious than a rock group at that time, certainly.
Right.
Rock was, like, bad. And I also got interested in the Alice pieces, many of which have this folk group, you know, two saxophones, mandolin, banjo, accordion. I put them as a little group because they are so unsymphonic. No one would ever consider that part of an orchestra. So it was like a separate Wonderland world that I'm putting on next to the orchestra. It always comes out of, for me, some sort of a musical, dramatic idea.
Also, we mentioned Brynjolfsson, and I mean, one of the other traits of your music, and you've written for male voice, but is the soprano voice, that high voice.
Most of my male singers have to be castrated to get the high notes.
Are they lining up for that?
They're mostly unwilling. Just only the real career fiends. No.
That's just the tone color which you always heard?
Well, I should tell you a story about Phyllis Brynjolfsson. Because I was invited to Tanglewood, and I wrote a piece for it called I Hear an Army, which is the first time I wrote a piece that was really high-flying for the soprano.
Yeah.
And she was invited separately. Little did I know, she didn't know either. She would be the most skillful singer of her generation. And we both met. And here I'd written this music. It was almost impossible for anyone but someone like her. And for her, it was easy. So I was amazed. It was so much permission. It was a little like Mio saying, "My boy, you're a composer." She said to me, my boy, you can write this kind of thing for soprano. It's okay. I can do it." Now, if she had been a typical soprano and said, "This is too high, too agile," I don't know what would happen to me.
Yeah.
But what did happen to me was I wrote another piece for her, even harder, and a third piece called Syzygy, which is really hard.
Yeah, so
and she did them all. And then I realized I have three pieces no one else will ever sing.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? 30 years later, a lot of people say
it. A lot of people say it.
Yeah.
Years ago, you had George Crumb on, and when he wrote Macrocosmos from 72, he said Robert Miller could play it, and Robert Miller could play it. There was like one pianist that could play it with all the prepared stuff. He said now high schoolers play it on their recitals, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the world we live in.
It's so interesting. But the important thing, though, is you do pursue something you're really intensely interested in, no matter what the cost is.
I guess it came from Copland, too, is to follow your instincts, to go with what you believe is...
What you enjoy.
What you enjoy.
Yeah, what you intensely enjoy. Joy is a very important barometer of where you should go.
Yeah.
You don't think about so much being different or anything like that, but where do I get joy? Because your skill is connected to your joy. Because you have to be happy to have your skill completely function. Like, technique is not just something mechanical that you pour on a piece. It comes out of being excited. Mm. And if you're not excited, your technique goes away too. It's all a package. Technique is not a separate function of music. Mm. This is what I find true of myself.
Setting poems by Colette Innes, a song cycle called Ms. Innes Says. We'll hear the first song from the set called Alive and Taking Names. The voice is that of Gila Plitman, the composer, and my guest today, David Deltredegy, at the piano.
A fellow radio guy, about 20 years ago, I guess, he did an interview with Bruce Duffy from Chicago. And he asked you a question, and he kind of did an evasive answer, which was interesting at the time. He said, are you looking forward to writing your best pieces when you're in your 80s? Well, you're there. You're there. So
I don't remember the point. What did I say?
You made some comment about Schubert and Mozart, and would have been interesting if they lived and what they would have written and da-da-da-da-da-da.
Oh, yeah.
But now the question can be asked because you're there. I mean, are you looking forward to... Where is the muse right now? Is he looking forward to writing some of your best pieces that are ahead of you? Or?
I just want to survive. Now, of course, health is an issue, and I'm okay, but I pray it lasts. And I still feel like I have my energy going, and I enjoy composing as much, but I have some physical complaints that it could, if they got worse, affect that. So I'm feeling like I want to write the pieces I can write while I can. And so composing now is my main function. I really like doing that. It becomes finite as you get in your 80s. You realize it's not going to go on forever.
Right.
Most composers are not composing in their 80s. And when you think of the past, certainly.
I know. Well, we're shut down way before that.
And we just die usually before that, because all of the diseases. And thank God there's a cure for syphilis.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you put that comment
or
in.
You get a or you get Verdi and you get a Boito coming up. I mean,
what did Verdi die of? How old was
just old age, I think. He was really old.
He stopped composing by 80. I think everything was written. Falstaff was written before 80.
Just before, but he had gone in retirement to do his farm before, and
then came back.
Boito coaxed him out.
Yes,
said,
exactly.
Come on, go do these. So, are there still commissions like lined up on the runway type of thing?
Not so many.
Okay.
But I have some commissions.
Okay.
But people now, it's different. Like suddenly they recorded Child Alice, and that's
right.
A wonderful thing. Better than any commission to have that recorded.
It is
so
good.
Well. So I'm getting some things I would never have thought of that make me very happy. I mean, I don't care about commissions. I care about feeling like writing.
Yeah.
And then when I write something, I find a way to get it played.
Well, keep it all coming. Keep it.
But, interest does shift to the younger generation, what they will have to do, and that's logical. It's always been that way.
But you still feel, if you write a piece today, that it's relevant, that it'll speak to,
I hope it does. I can't, no guarantees.
Well, you rub shoulders. You just did you did a performance of Satie's Vexations.
Yes.
And, of course, on that program, we were surrounded by a bunch of composer pianists who are kind of, hot or something like that, right? So they're around you, and they're probably looking at you sort of in awe at least respect.
I was in a special pen for the four people who had done it 25 years ago. We were all alive. That was nice. This is a very nice thing.
Like I said, keep it up. I close on my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions over 13 years. First is just a hypothetical, which if you could talk with someone from the past who you never had a chance to, when I ask that, what's the first name? Someone you just would really love to chat with, like we've been chatting. If you think about it, you get swamped. But when I ask
I was going to say Chopin or Schubert.
Really?
Those two. Why?
Schubert's one of the great what-ifs in my... Schubert and Gershwin are the two what-ifs in my book. Yeah.
I feel pretty close to Schubert because he was gay.
Yeah.
And Chopin... probably too, but the mystery of Chopin's music, I can't imagine how he did it. I just can't imagine. I would not like to meet Chopin so much as hear him play the piano. I'd love to hear how they actually were supposed to go, these wonderful pieces we all do. And Schubert, just the miracle of, what was he like? What kind of life did he have? Did he go out looking for young boys and then come home and write a piece? And how did he integrate his sex life with his musical life? Seamus Tchaikovsky, who is also gay. I'd love to know how they balance things.
Well, you didn't really get composing until you were over 20, right?
Yeah.
So, Tchaikovsky's the same way. He didn't really start going until he was like 21.
I don't think people are composed early. It's not...
No, but and then he died at 56, so he was only composing for 30 years, just a little bit longer than Schubert was.
Yeah.
Your Alice period lasted almost as long as
their
lives.
Oh, my God, that's all I got. No, Schubert didn't. He died at 31?
Yeah.
When did he start composing? 15 years, probably. If he started at 15, that would be like 16.
Yeah, so he was only
composing. Unbelievable. Huh?
Yeah.
They say that even copy out his music takes longer than 15 years.
Yeah.
Let alone think it up.
In the white-hot year of 1828, no one will ever duplicate,
What happened in 1828?
He just turned out all that stuff in one year, the last piano sonatas. Kept writing and writing and writing and writing and writing, knowing the syphilis was catching up with him, just writing and writing and writing and writing and writing.
I wonder what it's...
Knowing he'd never hear any of it, He'd be dead before he'd hear.
Same with Mahler and the Ninth Symphony. Mahler's music changed from the Ninth Symphony, Das Lied von der Erde, on. And I think it changed and got better, suddenly, I think. And I think the reason is he accepted that he was dying.
Mm-hmm.
When that set in, it gave him a new brace on life. A horrible paradox. when you really know you're going, you get all your best inspiration.
Focuses, yes.
The word is focus.
Final question is, everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. But when you have to do something that is non-musical, if you need to get away for a few minutes, I mean, I know you've been doing this for years and you live here and you get to create here, but if you need to step away, like pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can like separate you, what do you do if you have to get away for a few minutes?
The things I speak about, I can speak about.
Yeah, it's a family show.
Well, what do? I go to movies. That's one big thing. I don't go to concerts if I want to get away from it all.
No, right.
More of saying, I love to go to movies.
New movies, or are you in the older?
New movies.
New movies.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm very interested in that. Because there's so many wonderful movies that come out and disappear.
Yeah.
Where do they go? it's so creative, movies, I think, are the most creative way.
Well, it's the same as music. There's a lot of music written, and where does it go? It just disappears.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. What else do? I have friends I like to visit to pull me out of it. I never have friends my own age. Yeah. All my friends are younger because I think I'm younger. When I'm around younger people, I think I'm that age. Until something comes up horrible that reminds me, oh, you're way older. Like when they help me with my coat or give me my cane. I'm like, oh, my God, this is it.
Well, okay, despite that, you're still creating, so keep doing it. David Deltredge, thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure, thank you.
Composer David Deltredge. You can find out more about him at his website, daviddeltredige, Deltredige is DELTREDICI.com. The new recording, the first complete recording of his two-part Child Alice, has been released on the BMOP label, Boston Modern Orchestra Project. Check it out at BMOP.org. It features the Boston Modern Orchestra Project led by their music director Gil Rose and soprano Courtney Budd. I'll leave you with the final minutes from the final movement of Part 2 of Child Alice, titled All in the Golden Afternoon. Music by my guest today, enjoying his golden afternoon of life, David Deltredige. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to WWFM.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.